listening to WCPT 820s to the left with Samina and Shauna. And here are your hosts, Samina Mustafa and Shauna East.
Hello, world. Welcome to the left with Samina and Shauna. I am Shauna East.
I'm Samina Mustafa.
And we love you.
Yeah. And that was our, not Lady B. That was Lady D.
We're now calling Dr. D is now Lady D when he's just filling in for Ms. Lady B.
Yeah.
Sorry to confuse everyone.
Yeah, I don't know. We are back. We have a really exciting show today. We have Elena Hampton, who was part of the Madigan operation, and Letitia Wallace, a former state rep. We're super excited. We're talking about sexism on the left today, which is super important. Excited, right? But
I'm very excited.
Some important things people should know if they are listening to this. Where else can they find us, Shauna?
On the Facebook at facebook.com/to the left radio. We have our Facebook live stream happening right now. So please chime in with your questions or comments as long as they're 100% complimentary and never contradict us. And then you can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and everywhere else with the at symbol to the left radio.
Yeah. And we're going to take some calls later in the show, but you can always comment on that Facebook live feed. But before we get to those very important topics, it's been another ho-hum quiet week. Nothing's happened, right?
I was really bored. I just like painted my nails and got my taxes done and
oh wow. So let's not talk about that since that's not part of progressive politics. But we wanted to, I feel like this controversy is never going away, which is the issue of blackface.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of reared its ugly head again because of that Gucci sweater controversy. Northam is still in office. I was literally hearing this morning that there are still folks calling for him to step down. And then the attorney general has also been embroiled. Virginia has been embroiled in a blackface controversy.
But the third in line, correct? He admitted to that. And then the second in line has had two sexual harassment claims. So
yeah,
very complicated situation down there.
Right. But then someone, one of our friends, friend of the show, brought up an interesting point, which is Stella brought up an interesting point about that Northam had the issue with blackface, but Elizabeth Warren, you know, sort of had filled out, I can't remember if it was a license application in the state of Texas where she put her background as being a Native American or American Indian. I can't remember the exact.
It said American Indian.
Right. So and so she was bringing up a important questions like, you know, how do you deal with blackface versus, you know, her, you know, appearing to impersonate an indigenous person. So how do you feel about that?
I mean, I honestly think that Elizabeth Warren thought she had Native American heritage. It's her family has, you know, told her that since she was a kid. Obviously, she appears to be a white woman and lived in a white family. So there's definitely a cultural insensitivity at the very least that she is just not educated on what, you know, she should be identifying as. I am glad that she has finally apologized and that she has been in talks with the Cherokee Nation about this. And I really want to follow their lead and listen to what they're saying about whether they feel like this is satisfactory or not. I just want to make sure that we are looking at all of the candidates and how they're integrating Native American issues into their platform. I saw an interesting pundit yesterday was a Native American activist on MSNBC, and I really liked his answer, which was that, you know, she apologized. He found it to be genuine. This just shows like a larger ignorance about Native issues in America, and that he wants to see, you know, us to evaluate all the candidates and how they're going to address Native issues and not just fixate on her,
right,
which is sort of where I'm at.
Yeah, and I have a friend, Casey Brown, who is an Indigenous Native American, and we had actually talked, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to have him on the show at some point. But just so you know, like, he said, you know, this is one of those things where I just want to know, like, how are they on Native issues? Like, you know, I'm not going to dwell on this one particular incident. And he said, generally, she's been very good on these issues. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to have him on the show. We've also reached out to Kelly Hayes, who's a very strong advocate on this matter as well. So, I mean, the thing that is also interesting is Darlene Glanton, who's a columnist for the Tribune, to bring it back to the blackface issue, brought up an interesting point. She said, you know, Northam did this. It's, you know, it's wrong. But, you know, when you look at his record and what he's done, he's done some good work on racial equity. Now, I do also remember him having some problematic statements as it relates to immigration. So it's like, I feel like, and I think anyone who was in part of the progressive world knew that it was a Tom Perriello who's the progressive mm-hmm. candidate mm-hmm. that folks are backing. And so, you know, we kind of knew not that there was a racist component, but that there was, you know, we were dealing with a moderate versus a progressive going into
Correct.
This race. And so, you know, there's when you kind of peel back those layers, I feel like there's not that progressives haven't been racist. I mean, there's obviously we talk about it all the
yeah.
time. But there's definitely a little bit more like, oh, you know, the Roms of the world, the Quigleys of the world have all been sort of moderate centrist type of people. And when you look at their voting records and where, you know, they're getting their support and sort of like how they approach things, they're, you know, very much their record on racial equity is mixed at best.
Mm.
And so, you know, the folks who are sort of like coming after AOC and saying, oh, we can't abolish ICE, or, you know, that weren't coming out in front when it came to the Dakota Pipeline. I mean, these are all like, these are real policy issues where mm-hmm. you can show I'm standing for racial equity. And so, yes, the whole blackface issue is like, it shouldn't be ignored. I think it's an opportunity to really have a conversation. But it's also, here's what I think also gets lost. It's also really painful, right? When this comes up and people hear this and they see this and they're like, it's never going away.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I saw something with Trevor Noah. He talked about, you know, it's like, it's painful to think, like, here we are in 2019, we're still having these conversations about blackface, and people are still like, I don't understand what the problem is. And it creates I guess an environment where it's a little bit hard to have a really dispassionate conversation, because it is revisiting a trauma for people, just reminding them like, oh, there are people who literally don't respect me just because of the color of my skin. And so I think that's something that's sort of lost in all of this. So it's hard. It is just a hard conversation to have, but I think it's good
that we're having the conversation.
Yeah,
though.
But I'm like, but there's really great resources like search engines, like Google. I mean, like, there's a lot of information out there. And I also want people to step up and say, like, I will seek out information, and don't make just the people in your life or people of color be the you know, sort of the educators for you. You can seek it out. So I think there's a little bit of the Liam Neesons of the world, you know, the Ralph Northams. They are, their sort of mistakes are creating conversations, but they themselves, how they're responding to it, is also instructive.
Yeah,
like,
what's
how
up,
not to respond.
What's up with Northam saying, like, it seemed like a heartfelt statement, like, you know, this was in my past, I regret this racist behavior. Like, he acknowledged how painful it was, and then he said the next day that it wasn't him.
And
so
that,
what's that about? And now he's like been out of the public eye. He's just like missing.
Right.
And supposedly getting all of this cultural training, like, on the side. People are giving him books to read and stuff. I'm like, dude.
Yeah. But it's the same thing with Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson goes on whatever Good Morning America and is like, I'm not a racist. I'm like, no, actually.
Wait, what happened? I saw, like, a headline, something about him wanting to kill someone or.
So I'm going to give you the 10-second version.
Okay, thank you.
A friend of his said that she had been sexually assaulted, and he. I think it's alleged, like, the person was black. So he was just like, this was years ago. He was walking around and saying, like, I was just waiting for a black person to just get into it with me, and I was just going to kill him. Exactly. Just those of you who are listening on the radio, Shauna's making a face like, I can't believe somebody was hit. So that's
how entitled are you? I'm sorry.
Liam Neeson. So it understandably created a complete. And again, this is all in the backdrop of the Ralph Northam, you know, and also the Gucci sweater. And there's this interesting concept, and I have to find the post, which is called exposure trolling, where people are just, it was on this Ferguson website, which basically people do like crazy crap like what Gucci did or Prada, and they do these things with blackface or do something super racist, and it's like they're just trying to get social media attention.
Oh, yeah, like negative attention is equal to positive attention. At least they're talking about us, right?
Yeah, but the fact that, going back to Liam Neeson and Ralph Northam, it's like what Liam Neeson said, like, I wanted to just, someone close to me was hurt, and I wanted to just kill any black person. That's like textbook racism. That's what killed Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm.
That's what killed Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. Like, this sort of, like, assumption that a black face is somehow a menacing one, mm-hmm. and is associated with something that you need to somehow, like, violence against that image is okay. Like, that's racism. Like, that's it. Like, there's no way to sidestep that. I really don't understand what the issue is. Bringing it back to policy, though, in the case of Northam, if you have those three gentlemen step down, then I think you're stuck with the Speaker of the House, who's a Republican.
Correct, yep.
Who, mm-hmm. in terms of policy, would obviously be much worse than any of them. So that's.
But why the question for me is, why are we holding Democrats to different standards as Republicans?
We shouldn't.
Like I say, if we're gonna, you know, if anyone has a slip up and they feel like they have to wear blackface, oh my God, I can't. And then the excuses about, like, oh, it was just a costume. I just wanted to, you know, be Michael Jackson.
Well, so this is, I'm a brown person, for those of you who don't know. And, you know, like Gwen Stefani, for years, she wore a bindi, you know, which is mm-hmm. Something has, you know, spiritual, and it's not just like a costume. But people saw that as, oh, she's cool. She's with it. She likes, you know, Indian culture. And some people are just so want to be represented. So they're like, that's cool. But it has that same feeling of appropriation, like it's, you're reducing an identity to one thing, like people wearing a headdress or, you know, having the Washington team called the Redskins. I mean, all of these are part of that same really just kind of demeaning thinking. And it's like, no, you don't get it. And people are like, oh, but you can't just take a joke or whatever. It's like, no, this is a culture. This is white supremacy 101. Is that you don't respect these folks. Your frame is completely, is whiteness. And so,
also, your desire to have a particular Halloween costume is much less important than being sensitive to how that impacts people who will see you walking down the street.
Right.
Like, I'm going to admit something to you all right here. I admitted it to Jackrabbit the other day, and I'm going to just put it out there. I am a huge Otis Redding fan. I love him. I have always, for Halloween, wanted to be like zombie Otis Redding with, like, you know, like airplane parts and stuff, like to look like I was in a plane crash, because out of like my admiration for him, and also I love Halloween. But guess what? I can't. Deal with it.
No, you could. You just don't need, like, you know,
I would have to be me, the whitest white lady. And people would be like, what are you, like a plane crash victim? And I'd be like, I'm Otis Redding. It just, I'm just not going to do it.
Okay, okay. But you know, this is the
but
best.
But I'm admitting it. That's the first step.
This is the best. So Dwayne Kennedy is a comic in Chicago. I know we got to go, but he's hilarious. And I think he said something like, Ralph Northam is really lucky that when he was wearing blackface, he didn't run into Liam Neeson. And I was like, Dwayne nailed it. Like, that's perfect. That's but see, but that actually, that brings it all together. It's like you can wear it as a costume, but if you had to deal with the real world racism and consequences of being a person of color in this world, and it wasn't just a costume, mm-hmm. you would get it. Mm-hmm. You would get it right away. So that's, and I know we got to take a break and switch gears. So, but
next up we have Elena Hampton, who was a former Madigan campaign staffer. She's going to talk about sexism in Illinois politics.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later we have Letisa Wallace, former state rep, also going to talk about the same subject.
Yep.
So we'll be back in just 2 minutes with Elena Hampton.
Yep. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, Chicagoland.
Actually, no, world.
World!
aren't your friends in Finland watching us?
Sometimes.
Is it too late?
It is very late. It's like 7 hours ahead, so.
Okay.
Oh, no. They can listen.
Yeah. They can, we could be there at like after dinner. Like, you know, a little
good
sherry.
Good for digestion.
A little sherry and a little to the left. So we are back. I'm Samina Mustafa.
I'm Shauna East.
And we are really excited to host Elena Hampton. Thanks for being here, Elena.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Shauna, do you want to get us started?
So thank you for being here.
I could be there at like after dinner.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, why don't you go?
Okay, so I think I'm hearing myself in stereo here.
Sorry.
So, Elena, we're really happy to have you here. We just want to get folks to, if you could give us a little bit of your background, how you got into Illinois politics, just real briefly, and then we'll kind of get into sexism on the left.
Sure. So I mentioned before, it's a really uninspiring story.
Oh, no.
I got hired with the Democratic Party of Illinois right after I graduated from college. I started working on a campaign down in the Springfield, Decatur area, and I grew up in the Springfield area. And then halfway through that election, I was moved up to the Chicago suburbs on the race Kathy Willis against Skip Saviano, which is where I met Marty Quinn and Kevin Quinn. And then from there, I just continued working with them.
Yeah, and you also worked, I guess, kind of the biggest race you worked on was the Juliana Stratton-Ken Duncan race. That was a big...
Yeah.
A big win. So kind of fast forward to today, we're sort of limited on how much we can talk about, but you did leave the Madigan organization to because of allegations of sexual harassment, which are still pending. So we wanted to talk a little bit about how you felt as a woman in politics kind of coming up in the in your career, and how you feel like your perception has changed as a result.
When I was coming up in my career in Chicago, you know, I worked directly with Marty Quinn, so I was very behind the scenes. Not a lot of people knew who I was. They just knew I was the girl from the 13th Ward that worked with Marty Quinn and Speaker Madigan.
Which is common for women in politics to be doing the work behind the scenes and not...
Yeah.
Have people know.
Well, I mean, in general, that whole organization, they're very behind the scenes, mm-hmm. you know. So for me to be out in the public really vocal about this stuff is something completely out of the ordinary for me. But I felt like it was something that was really necessary. I feared that it was going to happen to someone else. And I just knew I couldn't. I didn't know how I would live with myself if I knew telling my story could prevent it from happening again. And that's ultimately how I came to the decision to speak out about it.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, that sort of conversation, the Me Too conversation, and Time's Up has really covered every sector. And obviously there's been some real repercussions, you know, whether it's Al Franken or, you know, John Conyers. And then obviously locally, how do you feel like that's changed the conversation about women in politics?
I would love to say that I think it has changed a lot, but I don't think that's the case. I think my story did create some changes in the state of Illinois. You know, certainly the statute of limitations was expanded to 365 days from 180. I know that they're implementing an HR department in the House of Representatives now. But as far as elected officials, you know, standing with me or standing on the side of justice, I think a lot of people have been really silent about it. And, you know, I think we need more elected officials to stand up and say, like, what happened was wrong, because right now we're just kind of being complicit in what happened. And it's not encouraging for other women or other victims in general to feel safe or comfortable to come forward.
Yeah. And I saw recently that you, I don't know if it was just this week, but that Chance the Rapper made an endorsement in an aldermanic race, the 25th ward for Ilario Dominguez. And he's also been endorsed by Chuy Garcia. And you quote tweeted Chance and said, you know, there have been some allegations around Ilario. You know, Chuy, Chance, can you? And did you get a response from them on that?
Oh, no. Not many people respond to me. With Hilario, I'm a resident of the 25th Ward. I'm really invested in that community. I've really taken my time to watch what's going on there and, you know, meet with candidates. And for me, having Hilario have these allegations, that's really hurtful for me to know that I have this alderman who is under criminal investigation now, you know, Danny Solis, and now right. I'm potentially going to have an alderman who is an alleged predator. I mean, that is, that's hard for me to sit with. And, you know, they are allegations. There has not been an investigation, and it just seems like no one is taking it seriously. And, you know, they are just allegations. That's what they are. But I think it's interesting how so many people are still standing with him, endorsing him, when there hasn't been any sort of investigation. You know, there was really no investigation in my matter, and that's part of the reason it's such a big deal. And I, you know, we're not really making any progress unless we're actually doing the work to investigate to see if something really happened.
One of the shortcomings that I have found with the Me Too movement, the hashtag movement, not, you know, what Tarana Burke created initially, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, is that it calls out particular powerful men and doesn't deal with the systemic issues. And as you mentioned earlier, you talked about no electeds are standing with you, hardly anyone standing with you. And that just shows like the abuse of power, because Madigan is so powerful that people are afraid or complicit. You know, they're very complicit. They don't go with the right thing. They don't do what's right because they know where their bread's buttered. They know there's going to be repercussions. They know they're going to lose their job or have someone ran against them or whatever. And I'm not excusing it in any way. I'm just wondering, how can we change the entire culture is my question, rather than just like focusing on individual bad guys. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's something I think about often. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I know that it's going to take more than one or two strong voices to say that this was wrong or to sacrifice their career for this. You know, it takes more people. It takes a coalition to make any sort of real change. And what we see here in Illinois politics is that there are very few people that are willing to do that. And it's disheartening. And, you know, when I decided to tell my story to the public, I knew that was going to happen. I mean, I worked among politics in Illinois for 5 years. By that point, I knew a lot of elected officials, and I knew how they were going to react. I know the type of control that Speaker Madigan has. So it was expected. Didn't make it any easier, certainly, but it was expected. And maybe even worse than I thought it was going to be. You know, like with the Women's Caucus, they never even made a statement referring to me by my name. And I think that just goes to show how complicit they are and how much they're willing to protect themselves over someone who was being harassed. And not only was I being harassed, I had serious evidence of it. So, you know, people make those choices. And the only thing we can really do now is work towards electing people that are going to be a strong voice for us.
Yeah, and you're kind of making me think a little bit about, like, going back to Shauna's question about systemic. I feel like in some cases, like in your case, you're not getting the support from electeds, people that you know and you've worked with. I look at kind of a not quite the same case, but something like Christian Gillibrand getting sort of excoriated for calling out Al Franken, and then people are sort of forgetting, like, 8 women came forward, like, and they're like, oh, but he didn't get any due process. That's a separate question. But he stepped down, you know, like, and it's not, instead, it's Christian Gillibrand's fault. And it's not, like, nobody is really thinking, like, Al Franken messed up.
And right? For most survivors of sexual harassment and assault, there is no due process. It's like, it ends up being a he said, she said.
Right.
And almost always defaults to he.
Right.
So how do we fix that? You know, these are just, it's very complicated and tough.
It is very complicated. And I think about it, I think people are very uneducated on how to help victims of harassment. And, you know, when I was experiencing my harassment, there were no shortage of people that didn't know about it. I mean, at least 20 people, and people that were in a position to help me, but they didn't. And I grew really resentful about that for a while, because during that my experience, I was, you know, I just had crippling anxiety and I was miserable. And then I realized, like, I can't be resentful, because it's not that they didn't want to help, it's that they didn't know how to. And, you know, that's something we should be talking about every day. Why aren't we educated enough on how to help people when they're experiencing harassment? Why aren't we educated on how to report it? I didn't even know how to report it. I didn't have anyone to go to except the brother of my harasser. And that's crazy.
Yeah, there was no mechanism, right?
There was nothing there.
On campaigns, it's like we've talked about it in the past. It's there's not a HR department per se to go to report, you know.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that I think is, so that's significant. I know that there's been some things that, like, I think Susana Mendoza, Carol Ammons, and I'm forgetting the third name, there was a sexual harassment panel. And
Karen
I'm just,
Yarbrough.
Yeah, okay.
She's not on the panel.
Oh, she
no.
wasn't? Okay.
I can't remember the third name, but I was just thinking, like,
Iris Martinez, did you say that?
No.
It used to be Sherry Bustos, and now it's...
Yeah, I'm blanking. But like, that was something that was sort of done as, okay, we're going to bring women and have women be essentially, in some ways, taking the responsibility for this conversation. And so there was a little part of me that was like, it's good that there's something, that there is a little bit of, you know, sort of institutional attention to this. But again, it's like saying, ladies, this is your problem.
Yes.
And so that kind of, to me, was like, you know, again, it's like, what about generally the guys who are creating the problem? So, like, what was one of the one, like, were there any folks in the organization that were experiencing what you experienced that came to you? Can you even talk about that?
Within the organization, no. I know of 2 girls that have had some pretty negative harassment and or assault situations in the organization that was covered, but those girls are not willing to speak about it, and I don't approach them about it.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to bring up as an education component to this show is that I want to see a lot more men involved in this discussion, because I don't think that the culture can be changed until they stop relegating it to us and saying this is a women's issue. Like, so it just ends up being a bunch of survivors, like, you know, crying to each other and sharing their stories. That goes nowhere. If men don't help us, if they don't say, if they don't, when they hear or see harassment or, you know of assault or whatever, they need to step up and say this is wrong.
Right. I mean, that's it can't be just up to survivors and people who are have experienced it in other ways. Like, I mean, I think, you know, everyone who heard the stories of the Me Too movement, there was, even if there wasn't something quite the same way, there was that flash of recognition. Like, I understand. And so there's like, I think that what's missing is you can have that flash of empathy, but what are you going to do about it?
Right.
You know, what, like, how powerful would it have been if somebody, if you had gone to somebody who said, I believe you, and mm-hmm. I'm sorry that this happened. What can I do?
Right. I mean, people did believe me. They either told me to not tell anyone about it. They didn't know how to help me. I mean, there was literally someone that said, I wish you wouldn't have told me that.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe you should date him.
That is, wow.
I mean, if people knew the things that were told to me while I was experiencing it, I mean, they would be appalled. Yeah. I felt like I had absolutely no one to turn to for help. And I mean, some people were people who had worked in the organization for 10 years. I mean, there are plenty of people who knew that could do something to help me, but it was a constant, you know, turning into a brick wall. Like, no one was willing to help me.
Right. And so going back to the education piece, obviously talking about it is at least a starting point, but again, it has to be a fuller, it's sort of like we were talking about with blackface mm-hmm. and the issues of, you know, Elizabeth Warren. All these conversations, they have a similar process, which is the people who are most affected are constantly being put in the role of having to educate everybody else mm-hmm. instead of the people who are essentially the perpetrators mm-hmm. or in a position of power to change the conversation are not taking a leadership role. Are there anything, like, if someone is sitting here and listening to the show and is not part of the political world, you know, what would you say to I'm going to assume it's a woman who's listening is thinking, like, can I be in politics? Is it safe? Or what should I be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I think people should follow their dream and do whatever they feel like they should do. They shouldn't feel held back because they're afraid of a man harassing them. I think as someone who is a survivor and has gone through this really difficult period for the past 2 years, I can say that it has been really hard. I cannot downplay that. But it was worth it. And if I were given the opportunity to do it again, I would do it in a heartbeat because I know the impact that it has made. And I would always encourage people to, you know, follow exactly what they want to do. And if you're in a situation of abuse or harassment, and if it feels right for you, you should certainly tell someone about it. But always do what is best for you. And something else I can say is, you know, never underestimate the impact that you have on somebody's life. Because if you look back on my story, like, this all began with one person and one inappropriate text message. And you know, all it took was to strip 2 years away from my life. And now I have to take one day at a time and get through this the best I possibly can.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing what you're doing and for your bravery. And we hope we can have you back again later to talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
And but unfortunately, we have to wrap up this section. But thank you so much.
Yeah, we really
appreciate
it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story and speaking up when other people won't speak up. So nice. Thank you for that. So we are going to be back with Letisa Wallace. We're taking a quick break and we'll be right back, Dennis.
Welcome back to the Left with Samina and Shauna. I'm Shauna East.
And I'm Samina Mustafa, and we are continuing our conversation on sexism on the left. And we are really thrilled. We're honored to have Letisa Wallace on the phone. Thanks for being on the show, Letisa. Sorry we're running a little behind schedule.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for your patience.
No problem.
So we're obviously continuing the conversation, but I also feel like Letisa has a really, has been such a strong advocate for women and women of color. And I really want to bring your perspective as a legislator and someone who is working on policy and pushing the envelope on, in these debates. And, you know, we talked about a couple of things. And so if we could maybe start with, and maybe we could start a little bit with, you know, how it was for you to be in office and then also running as lieutenant governor. And we'll start there. And what was like to be, what were your, how folks treated you as a candidate?
Well, I can say in the beginning, in 2014, when I was part of the consideration for appointment to fulfill my predecessor's term, immediately the sexism was quite apparent. There were conversations over whether or not, you know, where my son came from. You know, she had her son out of wedlock, was what someone called the chair of the party to make sure that he knew. The notion that I must have been somehow romantically involved with my predecessor, who's like my dad, that came up. And then even fast forward to 2017 and 2018, running for lieutenant governor, there were times when people would make just really awkward remarks because I don't think people are used to seeing members of the opposite sex run together as a team. And so when I would initially post selfies of Daniel and I to kind of, my joke was to him, we're going to document our aging process. but I noticed a few comments on social media when I would post those pictures, so I would stop because people would ask, you know, who is that? Is, you know, oh, he's very handsome. And, you know, the things just didn't seem germane to the fact that we were running together. Mm-hmm. And so
and
I
that
stopped.
You're, yeah, your own experience as a legislator and being a leader on these issues and giving you an opportunity to talk about those.
Oh, yeah. It was very interesting to see how things played out once I really became vocal about the culture that Ms. Hampton was just talking about. It is a very sexist culture, a very also racist culture. And I've talked about those things. And when I did, I learned very quickly that you should shut up, stay in your lane, or we will twist things and attempt to publicly humiliate you as a result of it.
And that brings me to what we talked about earlier as well, which is that sort of that toxic environment that is in place in Springfield, and how sort of stories and things get sort of manufactured to cover up the really real serious problems that aren't being dealt with by leadership. If you could speak to that.
Absolutely. So it's been about a year since, I'm not sure, my gut feeling is that the organization, one of the opponents that Daniel and I had in the primary, someone decided to pervert the Me Too movement and use a disgruntled former employee of mine to do that. And so I will say that I will apologize to Ms. Sanders because there, you know, it was revealed to me much after I let her go that she was not the person who had done the act that I thought she had committed in terms of missing dollars from my campaign funds. But on the day that I made the decision, it was based upon a phone call from my bank and the fact that she had been the last person who had access to my credit card. So I will say for anyone listening that I do apologize to for not going back to her once I finally learned that the case became larger than what I was. It actually went on to be an FBI case. But may I also say one last thing on that topic? And that is, I'm very disappointed in how stories can be manufactured, how stories can be twisted, and how reputable news sources can publish things and completely misconstrue the communication that they've had with an individual. They completely misconstrued the communication that I had with them. And by they, I mean the Tribune. But, you know, you live, you learn, and you move forward.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think, you know,
we could have a whole show about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that newspapers have corporate backing and have their own political interests and, you know, can be very biased and can twist your words to fit a particular narrative.
Right.
One thing that I'm curious about is I want to know more about your experience as a woman of color in politics and how sexism is even worse for Black women.
Well, I think because of the stereotype that Black women face, we're often over-sexualized in many media outlets. We're also expected to be, you know, superwoman.
Right.
So you're expected to be able to take certain things and not talk about it, or, you know, it's no big deal if someone comments on how you look in a particular outfit, or ask personal questions, or rather than shake your hand, feel that they should not just give you a hug, but, you know, a full frontal big squeeze and a kiss on your cheek. You're supposed to be able to look past all of that. And I think because of our history in this nation, you know, we've been the ongoing victims of all types of sexual abuse, assault, rape. And so we're expected to think that certain things are just not that big a deal.
Right. And that's,
you know?
And that you're supposed
compliment.
To, right. Yeah. And yeah, the whole superwoman, like being able to like be, you know, the person who comes in and fixes the problem, sort of like we talked about this a little bit earlier, which is the concept of Stacey Abrams being asked to do the State of the Union response, you know, in place of, you know, kind of whoever else they could have picked, Chuck and Nancy. and sort of like being that, like they're using Stacey Abrams and like the people's good feeling about her, but on some really meaningful level, it's like, yes, you asked a strong, incredibly capable Black woman to speak, but are you giving those Black women that you have the power to give leadership positions to, are you doing that? So like you had Stacey Abrams speak, give the State of the Union response, but what about when Barbara Lee wanted to be in a leadership role? So like, you know, those are the things that,
Right. And
so like we were talking earlier about how that impacts policy, because it's not just the face, it's like, is there a diversity of ideas? And we talked specifically about the minimum wage, since that just got, came through the Senate this week. So if you could speak to that.
Oh, yeah. So the minimum wage, obviously, people have been fighting for many years to raise the minimum wage in the state of Illinois and, of course, across the country. I find it interesting that when you look back to, I believe, 1968 or so, the minimum wage was enough for a single wage earner, for a family of maybe three, to actually get out of poverty. But that was also when workers typically were white and male. Now that we have more women in the workforce, although I argue, obviously, that Black women have been in the workforce for a very long time, now that the average minimum wage worker is a single head of household, more likely to be female, and disproportionately women of color, now all of a sudden we shouldn't be having the conversation about raising the wage and that they should just do better. And these are jobs that are supposed to be entry-level jobs. But that's not the case. And actually, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that was the point of the minimum wage, to make sure that people who worked would be able to provide for themselves.
Yeah.
And we can get into the nuances of the New Deal, too. But, you know, domestic workers were cut out of that. And
right.
That specifically was women of color, you know.
Agricultural workers.
Black women.
Yeah,
right.
Domestic service, agricultural workers. There was definitely the racism that existed in the New Deal. But, like, fast forward to today, and everyone's like, oh, this is so great. We're going to have $15 an hour. But it's like, no, we're not going to have it until 2025.
Right.
That's 6 years from now.
And I think there was, I think the Economic Policy Institute kind of looked at the minimum wage about 5 or 6 years ago when President Obama was trying to raise it. And the stat on a family in poverty being able to be helped by minimum wage, they kind of converted the dollar amount from 1968 to 2013 dollars. It would have been, if it were 2013, it would have been $19.50 an hour.
Right.
And here we are in 2019 still talking about how do we get to $15 an hour, when in many states it takes well over $20 an hour to even afford a one-bedroom apartment. So this is an economic justice issue. It's a racial and socioeconomic issue. And again, women of color, particularly Black women, get stuck in the middle of this policy debate.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, I mean, because whenever we talk about representation, people approach it like they're sort of cynical about it, like it doesn't make a difference or what's the point. But it's like, no. There are definitely cases where people are sort of, put in positions of power because they go along to get along. But when there's people like you who aren't going along to get along and saying, no, we really need to be thinking about this from a gender lens, from a racial equity lens, and then those voices are silenced.
Yes. One day I'll finish my book, and that's exactly the title of it, Silenced. Because back to the point of some of those hit pieces in the newspaper about me, the FOIA requests were received weeks before they were actually complied with. I mean, it was actually a way to weaponize a disgruntled employee. It was a way to weaponize and pervert the Me Too movement to silence a Black woman and to hurt the underdog ticket.
Right. And that there is quite a bit of research. I don't have it in front of me, but that opposition research in general tends to hurt women more than men candidates. And women of color certainly just aren't represented enough. So it's like it's sort of doubly damaging.
Absolutely. And again, I don't want to come off. I'm not a victim in that particular circumstance. But I will say that, yes, the point is that it was more damaging. It did result in my feeling ashamed of not even knowing at the time how to respond to some of the things that were in that particular article, but later introducing legislation to create processes and procedures. And that legislation did, in some form of it, did move forward. Of course, it was not carried by myself or by former state Senator Biss, but the conversation started, and I'm really happy about that. So at some point, there'll be some staffer who knows this is how you report harassment. At some point, there are legislators who will know that your title, which, as I experienced, your title doesn't inoculate you from the sexism and the harassment, but this is how you can address it. And to that end, I'm happy that the conversation was started.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask a kind of a question that I asked Elena, which is, if someone is listening to you, listening to this episode and thinking, what should I enter politics? I'm a woman. I'm a woman of color. Like, what am I? What should I be ready for? Like, what would you say to someone who's thinking about that?
I would say be ready for everything that you've experienced in other workplaces to happen in this arena. Be ready for the things you experience in the world as a person who is dealing with, as Crenshaw calls it, intersectionality. And use that strength that is also, like I said, often kind of damaging to Black women, but it's there. It's been built over time because we've been forced to be resilient. Use that to push through and pursue the goals that you have politically and the policies that you want to see that will make your life and your community better.
Yeah, and I wanted to just come back to something you and I talked about too, is that a lot of this has to be sort of self-driven and self-directed, and you have to kind of create that network for yourself, because as you and I were talking about earlier, there aren't a lot of avenues or structures or infrastructure for women who run. There's very few like incubators or programs that are Chicago or Illinois based that do that.
Absolutely. And people don't see Black women in particular. I can only speak from my own experiences. They don't often see us as leaders.
Right.
They see us as those who can. We are the campaign workers. We're going to get out. We'll knock doors. We will make the phone calls. We'll bring you to our church. We'll bring you over to introduce you to the people that we might have coffee with from time to time. But we're not always seen as the person who can be in that role. Again, going back to 2014, I'm the first Black woman to hold the seat that I held for the 67th District. And only the second Black person, only the second woman, and the first woman who held the seat, they made it very clear that they didn't expect her to run again because she was appointed as well. So there's so many things that women face, but particularly the fact that we don't always have the image of Black women being the, quote, title, being the senator, being the state representative, being the congressional member. We don't always have that. And so you have to really fight to make sure you create networks that can keep you strong and push you to getting to that goal.
Well, I want to also thank you for being so brave because, you know, I've supported you and Daniel during the gubernatorial race, and I've just been so impressed getting to know you. And
thank you
for doing all that you do. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up. We wish you could be here for a longer discussion.
We'll have you back on the show for sure.
All right.
I want to mention is this morning I reread Letisa's op-ed that was published in Teen Vogue, and we're going to share it on the live stream. It's about sexual harassment of Black women in government. It is excellent.
Yeah, that was a really awesome
Very
piece.
Good and definitely... has staying power and is relevant as ever, and we need to just keep talking about this. So thank you.
Okay, thanks
thank
so much.
You. Have a great afternoon.
Okay, thank
thanks.
You.
Right.
Bye.
So here we are. I checked the live stream.
No questions. A lot of comments though.
Because we're dropping so much knowledge.
Yeah,
Shauna.
They just don't even. Yeah.
So, but I just I you know the point. That we've been making, which is, you know, men need to step up and be part of this solution and not just having the burden be on survivors.
I do want to comment on Charles Kraft made a comment on the live stream. He said,
yeah. We got about a minute
It's
left.
Way too easy for men to get slapped down in half a second when they try to help. Come on, Charles.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe you're doing it wrong, but we need you.
Yeah. You tried it, Charles. You tried. Okay, we have a minute left.
Okay.
Next week, we're talking... to Melissa Sanchez of ProPublica. We're actually talking about another sort of racial justice issue, which is the parking ticket situation in Chicago. She's been doing some amazing work.
Very relevant to the municipals.
Right, because everybody has an opinion about it. We're going to do just a quick plug for the Medicare for All barnstorms and the canvases that are happening across the region. That's why we've got the Love It, Improve It, and Medicare for All behind you. So we're working with National Nurses United, and they're doing a national campaign, and we're talking to folks who are just, you know, voters, concerned citizens, to tell them about Medicare for All and get them to reach out to their representatives if they don't support it. Even if they do support it, we just want them to hear, yes, I am for Medicare for All. So
you can look at the National Nurses United website for that.
Yeah.
NationalNursesUnited.org. We just want to thank Ms. Lady D today and yeah. Anna, our production assistant, Elena Hampton, Letisa Wallace. Be sure to look out for our fundraiser at March 16th at the Hideout and get your tickets. And that's about all we have time for today, my friends.
We will see you next week. Thanks so much. Thanks, Dennis.
Bye.